ended by saying that Israel entered into a cycle. Well, as a matter of fact, the history of Israel has been just a repetition of that one cycle. You probably know already, and if you don't, you'll immediately recognize when I tell you that there are seven steps in that cycle. Brother Techman's pointed out the first one or two of those. The first is Israel, negligent of God's ways, tests his patience to the limit. That's step one. And step two, he sends in an invader to oppress the people. That's step two. Step three, there is a period of oppression, the intention of which is to make Israel come to their senses and understand what it is they've turned their backs upon. Step four is they call upon the Lord for salvation in their extremity, having nowhere else to turn. Step five, he raises up for them a deliverer. And step six, there's a prodigious battle. And step seven, a period of peace. And the whole of Israel's experience can be summarized in that. And it's a great lesson, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Whereas the Lord had called them to peace, by their negligence of his ways, they get back on the treadmill and they go around and around and around. The period of the book of Judges, about 350 years, is just a record of that story, over and over again. Go through the prophets, you find the same message. And right now we find Israel getting close to the point where the cycle will be run for the last time, and their Messiah will come, and the period of peace, which we call the kingdom, will be established for them. Now, what we're going to do this morning is we're going to look at my portion of this discussion this morning is we're going to have a look at Jephthah, an interesting character, Jephthah the Gileadite. He's a person who's always fascinated me and fascinated a lot of people, I guess, with the enigma which his life presents. And what we're going to do this morning is to tackle this in a slightly different way, perhaps, to see if we can understand what's going on by standing on the ground with this man and see if we can understand what is going on and to justify his position in Hebrews chapter 11 as a man of faith. And one of the very interesting things about Jephthah, if we turn to chapter 10 of Judges and 11, from which we'll draw most of what we have to say, one of the very interesting things about this man, Jephthah, is that the oppression from which he delivered Israel had been going on for 18 years. In chapter 10 and verse 8. We'll just look back at verse 6 for a minute. Here you see the cycle. Step 1, the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord to serve Baalim and Ashtaroth, and the gods of Syria, and the gods of Zidon, and the gods of Moab, and the gods of the children of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines, and forsook the Lord and served not him. That's step 1. Step 2, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. He sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon. That's the second step in the cycle. Now, the Philistines are generally down in the north, in the southwest, and well away from the area in which Jephthah is operating, and Gilead. If you have a map of Israel, you will see the Jordan running down the middle of the map, and Gilead, of course, is on the east side of the Jordan. And Ammon, the other nation that is mentioned there in verse 7, is further east still of Gilead. All right? And that year they vexed the children of Israel 18 years, all the children of Israel that were on the other side Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. So let's just for the moment put the Philistines aside, because Scripture doesn't specifically speak of what took place with respect to the Philistines. It just concentrates on the oppression of the Ammonites. 18 years. And that's step 3. There's the oppression. Step 4 in verse 10, the children of Israel cried to the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God and also served Baalim and the Lord remonstrates with them. Now, what I find very interesting in verse 17 of chapter 10 is that the record doesn't tell us that Jephthah organized an army and went out and fought, as, for example, Gilead went out and fought against the Midianites, or Deborah and Barak initiated the fight. In this case here, the Ammonites began the fight. And this is not characteristic of the rest of the book of Judges, though there may be a hint of it in the experience of Samson, but I don't want to pursue that at the moment. The Ammonites started the fight. Verse 17. The children of Ammon were gathered together and encamped in Gilead, and the children of Israel weren't prepared because they assembled together and encamped in Mizpah, and the people and princes of Gilead said one to another, "What man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon?" So here is a general mobilization against Israel, and Israel's not prepared. So they didn't start this fight. The Ammonites did. And that's a very curious circumstance. Why would the children of Ammon suddenly mobilize against the people that they had been successfully oppressing for 18 years? Something must have happened that triggered this reaction from them. And you'll see it again in verse 5 of chapter 11. So it was, when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. All right? So I just want to float that balloon for a moment. Just keep your eye on it. It's up there somewhere, and there's a string hanging down. We have to answer that question. Why would Ammon, after successfully oppressing Israel for 18 years, suddenly mobilize and come up and make war against them? We need to find an answer to that question, because it's a very important aspect of what's going on here. And we go on to chapter 11. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begat Jephthah. Now, I may be reading something into the record here, but this seems to me to suggest that Jephthah was the eldest son of his father Gilead. And just by the way, Gilead is a family name there. The original Gilead was a grandson of Manasseh, but that's 300 and some years before and more. So my impression is that Gilead has this son through the harlot and just takes him home. And then it says in verse 2 that Gilead's wife, and the Revised Standard Version, New International Version say, Gilead's wife also bare him sons. And once again, I may be reading something into it, but it rather suggests to me that these sons came along later. That Jephthah was, in fact, the firstborn in this family. Now, I'm going to suggest it. I'm not going to insist on it. I think it's likely. That's the best that I would say about it. And in process of time, the wife's sons grew up. And they thrust out Jephthah and said unto him, "Thou shalt not inherit in our father's house, for thou art the son of a strange woman." All right? And immediately the question arises, what did Gilead have to say about that? And the answer is, Gilead probably by this time was dead. This is the time when the inheritance is being shared out. And if he was the firstborn, then of course the chances are that he would have been entitled to a double portion, in accordance with that reading which we had this morning. And since this is a time of oppression, then the chances are pretty good that these are lean times. And that if you can get rid of the firstborn, well, then there's a double portion to be spread out amongst the rest, and there's a better percentage for everybody else. There's always a reason why people do things, brothers and sisters, isn't there? And sometimes it's a fairly menial reason. And so they thrust him out. Verse 3, Jephthah fled from his brethren and dwelt in the land of Tob, and there were gathered vain men to Jephthah who went out with him. And once again, reading a little bit between the lines, we get the impression that what he's doing here is what David did later when David found himself thrust out by Saul and found it necessary to make a living. You remember the passages in 1 Samuel chapter 22 and again in 27. Which we don't need to look up, I'm sure, because we'll remember the story. David fled from Saul. At one stage he found himself in the city of Ziklag, you remember, with 400 men who were in debt, who were outlaws, who were outcasts. Everybody who was discontented joined themselves to David, and of course their wives and family, and David had the job of looking after them. The way that he did it, you'll remember, was to pick on the enemies of Israel. He could have regarded Saul as an enemy and picked on Israel to make a living, but you know that that wasn't the spirit of David. And he dealt with the Philistines, he dealt with the people all around about him, as you remember, to make a living. Scorched earth policy, you remember, with David. He didn't leave anybody there to tell the tale. The question is, where did he get the idea from? The answer is, he may well have got the idea from sheer necessity, but he may also have got the idea from Jephthah before him. Vain men, empty men, men with no substance in their lives, gathered to him. We have no idea how many, but then we have this interesting phrase that they went out with him. And the inference that we draw from this is that they went out to make a living in somewhat the same way that David did years later. And the question arises, against whom do you suppose they might have made a living? What was significant about the land of Tob? Why did he flee there? And the answer seems to me to be suggested by just looking at the only other reference in the Bible to the land of Tob. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 10. And it's rather interesting that it bears exactly on the context that we're considering. Where was the land of Tob? And how did it relate to Israel? Well, in 2 Samuel 10 we have another story entirely taken from David's life. This was the time when the king of Ammon died and his son Hanun reigned in his stead, in chapter 10, 2 Samuel, verse 1. And you remember the story that David sent ambassadors to commiserate. And the intention of this was misread, misunderstood. The ambassadors were humiliated and sent home. And the outcome was that the children of Israel, of Ammon were not favourites with David. Verse 6, when the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David, the children of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 footmen, and of King Maacah, 1,000 men, and of the men of Tob, 12,000 men. Now there's a reference to the land of Tob in the book of Maccabees, but apart from these two that we've looked at this morning, these are the only two references, I believe, to the land of Tob in the Bible. And this one is very interesting because it tells us two things. Well, it tells us that the land of Tob was neither in Ammon nor in Israel. It was neutral territory. You see how it works. If the land of Tob was in Ammon, then Hanun would not have had to hire them. He could have conscripted them. If the land of Tob was in Israel, then they would not have fought against David. They wouldn't have been made mercenaries, you understand. So when we come back and take that piece of information back into the life of Jephthah, we find that he chose as a place to flee when he was cast out from his family. You see that he's chosen neutral territory, a place of refuge for himself, a place to which he can retreat. And the question arises, what would he have been doing? Who would he have been picking on when he was in the land of Tob, when he found it necessary to make a living, as David did with his vain men who went out with him? And the obvious suggestion is that he was picking on the children of Ammon. Now, immediately we suggest this, we start to understand a little bit about what was going on in the mind of Jephthah. He shared David's attitude towards these people that were oppressing the people of Israel. And he realized that the oppression was a reproach not only upon the people of Israel, but upon the God of Israel. And he took the first opportunity that he could to deal with this in the best way that he could. Now, there is a further suggestion that I would like to make, and that is, that the brothers of Jephthah were not the only ones to have cast him out, because we have that very interesting situation that the children of Ammon, having mobilized and come up against Israel and made war against them when they've been successfully oppressing them for 18 years, the children of Israel are unprepared. They don't have a leader this time, and they cast about for a leader. And in verse 5 of chapter 11, it says, when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. Now, why would they do that? I mean, why pick on an outcast who's been made an exile because of a family squabble? Why would they pick on him? He would have, one would have supposed, been the last person to choose. And in fact, when they came to Jephthah and asked him to come back, that's the very first question he asked them. And their answer is very interesting. Look down at verses 6 and 7. They said to Jephthah, come and be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon. So they knew that he was equipped to lead them. They knew that he had what it took to deal with the Ammonite threat. And once again, the question has to be asked, why did they know that and how did they know it? All right, something's been happening in the background that has not been recorded earlier, and it's there for us to lift out of the record. And Jephthah made the obvious comment there, asked the obvious question. He said, didn't you hate me and expel me out of my father's house? Why are you come to me now when you're in distress? Good question. Right? And notice what else is implied in that verse 7. He's not speaking to his brothers. He's speaking to the elders of Gilead, you see. And he says to them, didn't you hate me and expel me out of my father's house? So clearly the community as a whole had a part in this business of his expulsion. And whereas we read in verse 2 that the brothers thrust him out, and Jephthah responded to that and fled, which is interesting in its own way, here we have evidence that the whole community had thrust him out. There was something going on before he left his father's house which was an embarrassment to the whole community. And what I suggest to you is that what Jephthah had been doing when he was in his father's house was he's going around his friends and his brethren, everybody he could, and he would say, we ought not to be oppressed by the Ammonites. We ought not to be subject to these people. We ought to mobilize. We ought to get an army together and push them out. We can do it. Let's do it. And they took the attitude that the people of Judah did in the days of Samson. Do you remember when Samson dealt with the Philistines? The Philistines mobilized against Israel in exactly the same way that Ammon mobilizes here. Okay? Samson had slaughtered the Philistines, who naturally enough took exception to it, and the Philistines responded by mobilizing against Judah. And 3,000 men of Judah went to the rock Etam, you remember, and said to Samson, don't you know that the Philistines are our overlords? What are you doing making life difficult for us? And what I'm suggesting to you is that there's evidence within this record, just slightly under the surface, that this is what Jephthah had been doing. And it gives us a bit of an insight into the sort of person that he was. He of all Israel understood the reproach, and he of all Israel was doing something about it, and as a result of that, his own people thrust him out. They didn't want to hear that message because it was much more comfortable to live in compromise with the Ammonites. There's a tremendous lesson there for us, isn't there? And look at this here. When Jephthah asks, why are you come to me when you're in distress? The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, that's exactly why we're turning to you. Didn't you hate me and expel me out of my father's house? Why are you coming to me? That's exactly why we're coming to you. What a strange answer that is, unless there's a connection between their thrusting him out and they're coming to him and their need. And you can see immediately from that strange answer that the suggestion that I've made has got a fair bit to recommend it. So the elders of Gilead came to him and acknowledged before him that their part in thrusting him out, so that we may fight against the children of Ammon. and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And so Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, well, he said, if you bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon and the Lord deliver them before me, shall I be your head? Let's be clear about this. On the face of it, it looks as though he just wants power for power's sake. I'm suggesting to you that there's something else in that. I think that what he wanted was the situation to be clear. He didn't want any bungling amateurs to interfere with things and bring up questions of inheritance and all that sort of thing. If we're going to do the job, he's saying, let's do it right. It's going to be organised from the top down, and I want it to be clear that what I say goes. I think that's what's behind that. And they agreed to it. The Lord be witness between us if we do not so according to your words. Interesting, the grounds on which they said that. Witness, Galeed, Jiga Sahadutha. Do you remember from the days of Jacob when he made a deal with Laban and they set up that monument, Galeed, from which, of course, I guess Gilead is derived, and it means a witness. And they, perhaps unwittingly, invoked the spirit of Jacob in those words, the Lord be witness if we do not so according to thy words. So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and captain over them. And Jephthah uttered all his words before the Lord. Search and see if you can find another judge who made a deal with the people in a formal kind of way and ratified it with a vow virtually before the Lord here. This is not done as a deal between Jephthah and the people only. He brings the Lord into it. And so once again we see something of the spirit of Jephthah. Now, there are two or three things that are said about Jephthah that I'd like to straighten up. At least, to me, it's a question of straightening up. You'll have to decide for yourself what you make of it. The first thing is that it is often said that Jephthah was a rash man. He made a vow that he regretted. That's true, he did make a vow that he regretted. I'm going to suggest to you that it was anything but a rash vow in due course. And one of the things that I'd like you to notice is that he was anything but a rash person. Have a look at the lengths that he went to in talking to the king of Ammon before he took his sword out and started dealing with him. Before he even mustered an army, he sent messengers to the king of Ammon and he said, why have you come up against us? And the king of Ammon had this specious argument. Israel took my land, which we're not going to go into this morning. And Jephthah listened to him patiently, and then he set out and he gives him a detailed, step-by-step account of the history of what actually took place. And his argument is, we didn't take the land from you. We took it from the Amorites who had previously dispossessed you. All right? Now, a rash man doesn't do that. A rash man takes out his sword and starts waving it around. He doesn't start with words. Jephthah started with words. And I don't think there is another judge who did that. Every one of the other judges started fighting without parley first, if you understand what I mean. All right? And if you think there was just a chance, then there are two events in which Jephthah is recorded as fighting. The other one is with the tribe of Ephraim later on, and I'm going to skip over that, except just to point out that once again he began with words. He said, why have you come up against us in this spirit? Gave them an opportunity to answer before he dealt with them. Jephthah was not rash. He was perhaps the most considered of all the judges, at least as far as the record is concerned. Secondly, it is said that Jephthah did not know what the law had to say, and therefore, in ignorance of the law, could sacrifice his daughter. My answer to that is, no other judge could rattle off the facts, or did rattle off the facts, as readily as Jephthah did. And, as a matter of fact, I think that if we were to be asked, just on the spot, any one of us, just tell us exactly what happened when the children of Israel came up out of the wilderness and came into the land. Tell us the steps that took place and what happened. And I think most of us would be hard-pressed to do it. All right? So he knew the law. He had it at his fingertips. And he's anything but an ignorant savage, as some people will represent him. The next thing I would point out about him, about Jephthah, is that he knew the intricacies of the law, apparently. Because when his daughter, when the vow fell upon his daughter, and he obviously wasn't expecting that, verse 35, it came to pass that when he saw her, he rent his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are one of them that trouble me." Now listen to these words. "I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back." Now we read that so often we don't notice it, but it's kind of a clumsy way of saying, "I have promised," or "I've made a vow." He uses this phrase, "I have opened my mouth to the Lord." And it's straight out of Numbers chapter 30 and verse 2, which says effectively, if you make a promise to the Lord, then defer not to pay it. Do that which comes out of your mouth. And there are variations on that theme. You will find that formal statements such as that are ratified before the Lord, characterized by this idea of a coming out of your mouth, the things which proceed out of your lips, and those sorts of ideas. He knew he had the law of the vow in his mind when he made that vow. And you'll notice that his daughter also understood this. "My father," she says in verse 36, "if you have opened your mouth unto the Lord, do to me according to that which hath proceeded out of thy mouth." There it is again. Numbers chapter 30 and Leviticus 27. Numbers chapter 30, the basis upon which vows could be made in general. Leviticus chapter 27, vows dedicating people and what was to take place. And so we have some interesting ideas about Jephthah. What I've suggested to you is that he was a man of faith, that he understood where Israel ought to stand, and that he had done his best before he was thrust out of his father's house to deal with it. He was thrust out of his father's house. It says of him that he was a mighty man of valor. In a very short order, he had an army behind him, and he didn't go back and take it out on his brethren. And he easily could have. Okay? So this man has got an elevated spiritual perception. He's not ignorant of the law. He's not rash. So what we've done so far is to ask the question then, what on earth was he doing making a vow such as he made? And we're going to have a look at the vow and its consequences in our second portion. But let me just give you something to think about before we close. I have to wave a hand at this. We haven't time to look up all the quotations. But let me just remind you of the number of places, or a number of places, where people have been dedicated to the Lord in perpetuity. Virtual offerings, Isaac. In Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 to 19, it says that Isaac was offered, even though he was redeemed. The offering was made. The firstborn of Israel were an offering to the Lord, and they were redeemed by the Levites, who were a wave offering to the Lord. The idea of the wave offering was, if you take something and offer it to the Lord, you wave it to the Lord to acknowledge that it is his, and then you take it back. The acknowledgement was made to the Lord. That was true of the firstborn. It was also true of the Levites. And it's interesting to see how the Bible uses the words wave offering and heave offering in relation to these things. The Nazarites, an offering to the Lord, Numbers chapter 6. General vows, I've mentioned in Numbers 30. The singular vow in Leviticus 27, dedication. The Gibeonites, remember the Gibeonites who misled Joshua and were condemned, in inverted commas, to a life of service, drawers of water and hewers of wood. They were dedicated to a life of service in the tabernacle. The Nethinim, who are mentioned in Ezra and Nehemiah, the word is just the plural of Nathan, given, the Nethinim. They were given to the Lord, they were offered as a wave offering, they were raised up. The Midianite girls who were captured in Numbers 31 and divided up, one of 50 from those who went to war, one of 500 of Israel's portion, given to the Lord and offered as a wave offering. They were all offerings. Anna in Luke chapter 2, and we're going to look at Anna a little bit more later on. Married woman, her husband died, And then she dedicated herself to the Lord in perpetuity. And what I'm going to suggest to you in the second half is that this is what actually happened to Jephthah's daughter, and that the idea of her being offered is in conformity with these vows and these other examples and precedents which are found in various parts of the Bible. The ministering women, the singers. And just to give you something to think about without being definitive about it, 2 Chronicles chapter 9 and verse 4, the word for burnt offering contains no idea of burning as such, though when an animal was offered, as usually was the case in a burnt offering, that's exactly what happened to it. The basic idea is illustrated here. There are other places too, but 2 Chronicles chapter 9 and verse 4, you'll find this word. King's Chronicles. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 4. Chapter 9, verse 4. It's a reference to the Queen of Sheba. And you'll see this word as sent there in the middle of it. The meat of his table, the sitting of his servants, the attendance of his ministers, and their apparel, his cupbearers also, and their apparel, and his ascent by which he went up into the house of the Lord. That reflects the essential idea of the burnt offering. That is the word for burnt offering. In fact, the New International Version translates it, his burnt offerings, which he offered in the house of the Lord, but the Hebrew means just ascent. It is the idea of being raised up and dedicated to the Lord. In other places where people are involved, the idea is the wave offering or the heave offering is used, but I'm just suggesting to you that this allusion to the burnt offering was fulfilled in Jephthah's daughter in her being dedicated to the Lord in conformity with those laws of the vow.